The Soul. The expectation of the positive revelation, which prepares the way, to a large extent, for its reception on indifferent evidence, is based upon two fundamental propositions of natural religion: the existence of God and the spirituality and immortality of the soul. Once the material world comes to be regarded as a translucent veil that hangs for a time between a personal God and a human spirit, vaguely conscious of a high destiny, the search for some positive message from behind the veil is natural and hopeful. If, however, these beliefs are themselves found to have little or no rational justification, the study of positive religions no longer presents itself as a matter of such vital importance and of so promising an issue. Consequently, the ingenuity of the religious philosopher has exerted itself in every age in accumulating motives for clinging to this worldwide belief. But if, in the preceding case, the arguments for the traditional belief have undergone many changes in the progress of thought, the same may be said with much more obvious truth in the present instance. The motives found in the eloquent pages of Plato appeal to few minds of our generation. The arguments of Aristotle and his scholastic commentators are discarded even by most of their own modern followers. New arguments of the most approved and invulnerable type have been invented to meet the critical mind of this rapidly maturing race, and even science, the phantom that has scared so many religious souls during the present century, has been pressed into the service of spiritualist philosophers. But if there is one point on which science has shaken the confidence of men in traditional teaching, it is on this question of the possession by man of an immaterial soul. Metaphysics is, from the nature of the case, the ultimate court of appeal in such a question. The crude assertion that scientists reject the soul because the microscope, the skiagraph, or the scalpel has never revealed it, is one of the choice expressions invented by theologians who never read scientists for the satisfaction of their people, whom they will not allow to read them. Neither literally nor metaphorically is it a correct statement of the case. The truth is that there are two forces at work in modern physical science, which proceed satisfactorily until we come to human psychology, and which the scientist is naturally loath to relinquish at this point until the gravest possible reasons are shown for respecting the immunity claimed for it. On the one hand, we have this law of unity or parsimony, the tendency to restrict, as far as possible, the number of ultimate factors of the universe. This is a natural protest of a sounder scientific spirit against the reckless multiplication of forces and principles of less enlightened ages, when all different sets of phenomena were attributed at once to radically distinct principles and supposed to be explained. On the other hand, there is the law of evolution, the most brilliant discovery of the century, which has shed so marvellous a light on the past history of the world, and which now only encounters serious opposition when it deals with the origin of human intelligence. To show that a mechanical or monistic view of the universe and an acceptance of evolution cannot include man, it is necessary to point to certain of his characteristics which reveal the presence in him of a new and specifically distinct principle. Until that is done, the claims which evolution and mechanicism derive from their already universal application cannot be set aside. Difficulties in their application there will be, but difficulties, as theologians so loudly protest in other matters, are not objections. The philosophy which I taught was, of course, essentially dualistic. It takes a middle course between materialism and Berkeleyan idealism. Moreover, it teaches that the human soul is not an isolated spirit, as in Plato's and Descartes' teaching, in absolute contrast to the rest of the universe. The immaterial world is interwoven much more intimately with the material. The problem, therefore, on which my mind was exercised, and in the solution of which I came to my present attitude, was to establish clearly the frontiers of the immaterial world, where we could confidently face the rising tide of scientific naturalism and say, "Here shall thy proud waves break."